So you're absolutely right. I think our goal has to be hope, and it does require anger. Like I say, there's a lot of anger going around these days. I think we've all got enough anger, but what it really requires is that twin sister of courage.
I love all the guests that come on the show. It is a privilege and an honor. Anytime a busy entrepreneur, a leader, takes some time to reflect on what they've accomplished, share some of the insights and stories from how they've gotten as far as they have and earned the insights that they are acting upon. But today's episode stands out. The author, Ben Hunt, is someone whose writing and philosophy and thinking has served me like a flashlight in a dark room, helped me really consider a number of things differently. And I hope that after this interview, you'll be motivated to head on over to his website, Epsilon Theory, and read some of his tremendous writing. Ben has a varied background that he details at the beginning of the interview as a PhD, a professor, a chief investment officer, and the head of a hedge fund. And the intellectual horsepower required to fill all those roles is on full display in this interview that I share with him today. He's also a father and the head of a household located on a 44-acre farm. And just an all-around fascinating dude. I think that you are really going to take a lot from this conversation. And I hope that if this is your first exposure to Ben Hunt, that it is not your last. Here is my conversation with Ben.
You're listening to Going Deep with Aaron Watson.
Ben, thank you so much for coming on Going Deep. I'm really excited to be talking with you.
It's great to be here, Aaron. Thanks for having me on.
I wanted to start off on just a little bit of a different tenor, and this is as much a cue for you as it is for the audience, but it's really an honor to be speaking with you because of how much I admire your writing and your blog and your capacity to... And I was even talking about this with a friend as I was prepping for the interview, how you're able to put words and articulate some of the complaints or elements of this kind of wacky world that we're living in so clearly that it helps to make sense of all that's going on. And so I really appreciate that. And I think that a natural starting point for that is to talk about how you were able to use this beautiful analogy, I don't know if it's the right word, but this analogy of the statistics associated with casualties in the Vietnam War, mm-hmm. and to use that to assess and understand some of the first numbers and the first data that we saw indicating the fatalities associated with the coronavirus with COVID-19. So can you talk a little bit about what you saw and a little bit about how your background kind of enabled you to use that lens to parse through that information?
Sure. Well, thanks for the kind words, Aaron. And, you know, I have done a lot of different things, and I think that is what helps to communicate issues principally around the world that I'm currently in, the financial world. And really try to communicate that to a broad audience, right? That you don't, so often, and this isn't just true of investing, but it's true of everything in this world, you feel like you're an outsider, that you have to have access to the secret language, you know, that the practitioners speak, right? If you're not aware of all the inside baseball lingo and, you know, ideas, it can be intimidating. And I got to tell you, I think that's entirely intentional, frankly, because the ideas that really dominate the world of investing or the world of politics or whatever world your audience listener happens to be in, you know, frankly, it's not that complicated. It's the same things that human beings have been wrestling with for thousands of years. And so I do think it helps to have a varied background. You know, as my wife says, I can't keep a job, right? So I was a professor, a college professor for 10 years, and I started a couple of software companies. And then I got into the investing racket. I was going to call it a business, but it's a racket. I built and ran a pretty big sized hedge fund for a long time. And now I'm trying to write about all those experiences and tie them together to really to help myself and help others see the world through these lenses, which I hope are simplifying lenses and getting past the jargon and the language. So roundabout background to your very basic question, which was that when I started writing, this is at the end of January, so published the first piece on COVID-19. I don't think we called it COVID-19 that first weekend in February, but I was focused on what I thought was the clear lying that was coming out of China around their numbers, their jargon, their statistics that they were reporting coming out of their experience with the novel coronavirus and the city of Wuhan in particular, the province of Hubei a bit more broadly. And what I was really drawing on there was my academic background. I was a professor of political science of all oxymorons, right? And I got my PhD up at Harvard, and I taught at NYU, and then I got this tenured spot down at SMU in Dallas. In my field, it was broadly political science, but more specifically, it was, I'll call it more on the science side of political science. It was really statistics, econometrics, trying to both make sense of numbers and statistics, but also it's a lot of training in how governments, companies, how people lie with statistics as well, right? It's that old saying, lies, damn lies, and statistics. Well, what we were seeing coming out of the numbers being reported out of China, they followed up a certain pattern. And, a couple of people were writing on, it was a Reddit thread of all things, trying to do a statistical analysis of that. And a lot of the statistical analysis that they were doing on Reddit was kind of silly. But the core insight, I dug into it, and the core insight was absolutely correct. And the core insight was, these numbers are being made up. These numbers are being fake. And you say, well, how can you tell, right, by looking at just the numbers? How can you tell if they're fake? And the reason you can tell, and this is going to have applications to when we talk about markets, when we talk about politics, when we talk about really anything else. We know the numbers were faked because we know something about the real world biology of any virus, of any disease, any contagious disease. And what I mean by the real world biology is that numbers can describe how contagion happens. And the way numbers describe that is to use what we'd call an exponential function. And exponential growth in something is something, frankly, we don't experience very much in our human lives. And so it's a difficult concept to kind of wrap your head around. There are lots of ways, growth in which we are familiar with, the growth of a bank account, the growth of a stock, right, or what have you. But exponential growth is this really weird thing, because the way it looks to a human observer, it basically looks like nothing is happening for quite a long time. And then you'll see, as I like to describe it, if you see an exponential function in nature, it'll look like nothing, 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 and then you'll see cluster, 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 and then all of a sudden, boom! It is as if almost out of nowhere, it just explodes on you. And that's why when you see these exponential functions, in some sort of chart or graph, it'll just creep along the bottom for a long time, and then it'll go sharply up. Well, that's how a disease starts. And then, of course, you have the reaction to the disease, right? You have treatment. You have you know, public policies like we're seeing with social distancing or a lockdown or what have you. And it changes the trajectory of the disease, right? Thank God. But it doesn't make it into what we call a quadratic formula. It becomes what we call a sub-exponential function. Again, I'm using this jargon, but trying to explain what the jargon really means. What was clear was that in the data that China was reporting, both in the cases they were reporting, and I think even more importantly, in the deaths that they were reporting from this disease, it was impossible to come up with any exponential function that a disease would take in the early stages and combine that with some sort of mitigation and the like to turn it into a sub-exponential function. There was no combination of those two real world things, the spread of a disease and the efforts to try to contain it, that could result in the numbers that were being reported. I mean, in statistics, you talk about this notion they call, you know, you hear somebody say, what's statistically significant? And all that means is, how likely is this explanation, the numbers you're seeing, how likely is that it could have occurred by chance, by something else? And so when you run these kind of statistical significance tests on the data we're coming out of China, you know, my rough estimate was that it would be more likely that our sun would go nova and destroy all life on Earth tomorrow than that these results that the Chinese government were reporting were what were really happening. And so I wrote about that in this note, and I called it body count. And the reason I called it body count was that I think I know why China was lying about the numbers. And they were lying about it in a pretty kind of simplified way. They basically, the numbers that they were reporting were really intentionally designed to show progress, right? They wanted to show competence and control on the part of the government. They didn't show that sort of exponential, you know, attack of the virus followed by, you know, a fight. And it is a fight. It is a war against the virus. It really showed it kind of, well, it's manageable, and now we're really managing it because we're smart and we're in control. And what it reminded me so much for, so I'm 56 years old. When I remember so vividly just a little kid, you know, 6, 7 years old, you know, I'd be at home and my parents would have the nightly news on, Walter Cronkite or Eric Severide, you know, one of those old time guys, right? And this was during the Vietnam War, right? So I was born in 64. So this is like 1970, 71, and like. And I still remember vividly, right? They would always report exactly how many North Vietnamese soldiers had been killed or wounded that day. Right? And that was always like 10 times the number of South Vietnamese soldiers, and you know, and the South Vietnamese was always like 5 times the number of Americans. And what we know now is that those numbers that were being reported about the North Vietnamese casualties were made up, right? They were maybe roughly kind of true, but basically they were being made up in exactly the same way that I believe the Chinese government was making up the numbers around the coronavirus to present this narrative, this story, this frankly illusion of competence and control that the U.S. was winning the war in Vietnam, in the same way that China wanted to present this narrative of winning the war against the coronavirus. And what's worse, and this is where I'll stop with this, because the story doesn't end with the Chinese government lying about the numbers, right? But the kicker to this, and this was absolutely the case for the American experience in the Vietnam War, the tail begins to wag the dog. And what I mean by that is that once you go down this path of creating a narrative and making up the numbers, you, meaning the government, start to fight the war. Again, whether it's a war against a virus or a war against an enemy, you start to fight the war, your policy becomes designed to support the numbers you've been talking about, the numbers you've been making up. And in the U.S. case, this was the source of what we call the village pacification policies. You know, most of the movies you see about Vietnam are really driven by the policy that came out of this perceived need to present every night these numbers of North Vietnamese soldiers dead and wounded. That's why we were winning the war. And I think that's absolutely what the Chinese government did. It's absolutely what organizations like World Health Organization did after that. And sadly, I think it's exactly what's happened in governments all over the world, both in Europe and here in the United States.
Yeah, it's frustrating, and it brings me to the St. Augustine quote that you have in your Twitter bio, which is, "Hope has two beautiful daughters, anger and courage. Anger at the way things are, and courage to see that they do not remain as they are." And one of the kind of, I think, outgrowths of this inevitably will be anger. There will be anger at how it was handled. There might be misallocations of anger. There may be misunderstandings in different kind of corners of the populace at like who is culpable, or maybe it'll just be a differing of focus of, hey, I see it here, you see it there, and people going on their different directions. But what is to me dangerous is anger and either a lack of courage to take the appropriate action, or a lack of sophistication about the appropriate or the effective steps that one can take to channel that anger into good, into hope, into something that that positively will be born of it, and not just, you know, descend into nihilism or anarchy or something like that.
Aaron, I think that's so right. And you know, that is just my favorite quote ever, the St. Augustine quote. We're not sure if St. Augustine actually right, said that. He says some similar stuff to it, but I prefer to believe that he said it. And you know, if you recall, St. Augustine was watching the long-term decline and fall of the Roman Empire. That's the time period he lived in and what he was viewing. And so you're absolutely right. I think our goal has to be hope. And it does require anger. Like I say, there's a lot of anger going around these days. I think we've all got enough anger. But what it really requires is that twin sister of courage, and that you put those two together to channel the anger in a way that can provide hope, to avoid a long fall, but try to rebuild in a better way. And the way I'd suggest thinking about that is, you know, I mentioned that it was the Chinese Communist Party lying about the numbers and the minimizing the severity of this disease to try to maintain control. And I say international organizations have done it. And then similarly, I think that's happened in the United States, where the disease has been minimized and has been politicized by every institution. And when I say every institution, yes, of course, I mean the White House. Right? Of course I do. I also mean Wall Street. I also mean the media. Right? This is... I think, and I use this word betrayal, and I don't use this word lightly, but all of these institutions who have told us a story of why they exist and why they are there for us, I think that the actual real world events of what they've done during this crisis over the last few months, it just gives the lie to that. So when I say that our institutions, I believe, have betrayed us, this is not a left or right thing. This is not a Republican or Democrat thing. And that gets, I think, to me at least, at the heart of you know, your point about, well, how do we channel our anger here? I think it would be a mistake. I think it would be a tragic mistake to channel our anger, to channel our belief into the idea that the election this November will either fix what was wrong, will punish or reward the people who are to blame for this. The blame is not, I really believe this, in a particular institution or a particular political party. The blame is in the system we have today, where, again, we, the people, are being undermined from above, right? Where it's a financialized economy, where the wealth disparity and the income disparity just gets wider and wider. You see that in the response to this virus even today, where everything is done on this trickle-down basis. And it requires, I think, a rejection of the system that, whether it's from the Democrat side or the Republican side, both pushes this forward. And by rejection, I don't mean, moving off the grid. I like to talk about burning it down, but what I mean burning it down, I mean burning it from the inside, burning it from the bottom up, burning it by replacing it with community action that doesn't get trampled by these elephant institutions who will absolutely trample you, but it really means reclaiming an autonomy of mind, an autonomy of spirit, so that you're not just cannon fodder for the wars that these institutions wage on each other. I think there's some very specific bottom-up things that we can all do in our lives that keep the ideals of what I'll call small L liberalism and small C conservatism alive. Because those are the ideals that I think we've lost. You know, we pledge our allegiance, we talk about freedom and justice for all. And those are the things that are lost when our institutions create these narratives and use data, quote unquote, to prove their narratives, when they're just making it up. They're making this shit up, Aaron.
Yeah.
And I think once we see things with clear eyes and we embrace it with full hearts, you know, that's the secret to the world, man, is to see the world with clear eyes. Find other people who you can go at the world with full hearts, and clear eyes, full hearts, can't lose. That's Friday Night Lights, the great book and movie, and an okay movie, but a great TV show.
Amazing series, yeah.
That's the slogan, right? Yeah. It's about high school football in a small town in Texas, which is to mean it's about life. It's about life, and that's how you get through life. With a team, with your pack, and going after life with clear eyes, full hearts, and can't lose.
I want to hang on to the small L liberal, small C conservative idea, yeah. Because another one of your concepts is this widening gyre, which is at the macro level, we have this pulling apart of extremes. And for someone, I would throw myself in that category, but particularly younger, where we can't even necessarily remember a time, or it's to remember a time when the two poles of political thought were relatively close together, and there was a capacity to see elements of similarity in the person across the aisle, and that becomes harder and harder and harder. But in a lowercase or a small L, small C environment, I go back to a book by Sebastian Younger, Tribe, where he talks about the healthy tribe had its balance of conservatism and liberalism, the capacity to have empathy and care for that other person in the community and sacrifice yourself for them. but yep. simultaneously a capacity to, you know, with clear eyes or from a calculating standpoint, recognize the risk to the whole tribe brought on by the kind of weaker elements and that balancing, it was seesawing in any capacity at 150 people at, you know, 300 million people, but the recognition that that is actually a healthy balancing act to strike as opposed to this thing that feels like it's pulling us apart because of its extremism.
Yeah. And look, this has all happened before. It is funny how history, it really doesn't repeat itself, but there are these patterns and this is one of those patterns, but I can also give you examples of where a nation, a people, they rediscover that fire that really binds them, that brought them together in the first place. And it is, I believe, these small L liberal ideas of, again, liberty and justice for all, right? That's what the small L liberal ideal is all about. It's about an individualism, an autonomy, a freedom of mind. And that's what is whittled away by the use of narrative and technology and social media and the like. It whittles away at your autonomy of mind. Similarly, the small C conservative idea, it's all about honoring the past, whether the past takes form of your ancestors, it takes the form of your community. It's seeing value in tradition and the way things have been done in the past. It doesn't reject that things can't shouldn't change, but it recognizes that there is value in those ties that bind a community together. And that's similarly under attack from the stories and the narratives that we are told. Right? And it's this, it reflects itself in our politics, where again this notion of the widening gyre, the there is no median voter anymore. You know, we are getting more and more polarized as a society, and that's entirely intentional. It's entirely intentional, and we're becoming more and more polarized in terms of our economics as well. Again, entirely intentional. So many things, though, that once you see through it, right? Once you see things through a different lens, once somebody just points something out to you, you'll see the world differently. And that's why I think it's so important to, again, tell these old stories, but tell them in a new way, so that people say, "Huh, I am being lied to. You know, I am being betrayed." And it's not those darn Republicans or those awful Democrats. It's a power thing, right? Not necessarily a political party thing. But once you start looking for it, you'll start to see it everywhere. And then you can start to protect yourself from it. And we can talk about how to do that.
Yeah, I want to be super respectful of your time because we've already gone for 30 minutes here and you've been so generous with that. So I'm going to aim towards wrapping up just to be respectful of that and encourage people and link in the show notes for everyone to check out some of your writing that you've outlined some of that stuff. But I do have two quick questions before we aim towards wrapping up, Ben.
Sure.
The first is, you're an Alabama football fan. How do you think Tua's going to do in Miami?
Tua's the real deal, man. He's not just an amazing quarterback, right, with a great release and the like, but he's a good person. And frankly, I feel the same way about Jalen Hurts, you know, who transferred out of Alabama, went over to Oklahoma for a season, and the Eagles got him. So any of you, I think you've got a Pennsylvania audience, maybe
sure.
More Steelers than Eagles fans, but I think the Eagles got a great one in Jalen as well. And I'm just glad that, you know, the Patriots did not get him. So that makes me happy.
Respect. I'm engaged to a Patriots fan. So there's a little bit of household strife
there. Well, look, so rooting for the Patriots is kind of like rooting for Alabama. You know, it's like rooting for the Death Star. You know, yeah. I mean, it's yeah, if you come by it naturally, I mean, I was born into the Church of Bear Bryant, so grandfather played in Alabama, so it comes naturally for me. But it's a challenge, that's for sure.
Yeah, she was born in Boston, so it comes by it naturally as well.
Good.
My last thing, and I apologize that we're going a little bit over here, but the one of the poignant moments for me of the year before the whole pandemic thing was the passing of Kobe Bryant. And on SportsCenter, L. Duncan gave this amazing monologue about Kobe Bryant, not the basketball player, but the girl dad. Yeah. And you are the daughter of four girls. Oh, I'm sorry, misspoke. Father of four girls. And part of the raising of them has been on your farm. And so I'm curious if there's any, or I'm sure there's countless, but some of the kind of core things that you've learned about being a girl dad through the lens of raising your family on the farm.
So like you, I was so moved by that particular remembrance of Kobe Bryant, and so much of what that article said about what it's like to be a girl dad, you know, rang true so much for me. So hang on, how to think about this. There have been realizations for me personally being a girl dad, because I was raised in a boy family, you know, with a brother, and you know, we were very much a male family that I was raised in. And it's I've had a lot of, I'll say, personal growth by seeing my daughters deal with what is still a male world in so many respects. But it's helped me grow, frankly, by being a girl dad. But what I will say, just in terms of the lessons and the life on the farm, there are only two things that I take care of on the farm, right? So I drive the tractor, and I take care of the bees. Everything else on the farm, my girls do, right? They take care of the sheep, they take care of the horses, they take care of the goats, the dogs, the cats, the chickens, right? It's all on them. And when I say it's all on them, I really mean it, right? Whether those animals live or die is on them. And whether you're a boy or a girl, I think that having that sort of responsibility and seeing that there truly is, as they say, you know, that circle of life, and living the need to show these creatures respect and care and love, it's been everything. It's been everything. These are lessons that I think are difficult, not impossible, but difficult to teach in other circumstances. But they are lessons of resilience, teamwork, empathy, care, strength that are that you got to learn sometime. And you know, that's maybe not unique to being a girl dad experience, but sure is gratifying to see my girls grow up into such strong women as they experience these lessons.
It's a beautiful note to wrap up on, Ben, and it's inspiring for me, and I'm sure many of the listeners out there, to try and continue to get access to some of those lessons. I'm going to encourage them to read over at Epsilon Theory and follow what you're doing with Frontline Heroes to get PPE to healthcare workers who are critically in need of that. What digital coordinates, if any, do you want to make sure that people spend some time checking out?
Well, thanks for mentioning both of those. So, you know, as far as my blog and research and writing, that is Epsilon Theory. So that's at Epsilon Theory on Twitter. That's epsilontheory.com on the web. You know, we make free articles available on the website. It's I think there's some interesting observations there, right? For both politics, a lot on markets and investing. I'm glad you mentioned Frontline Heroes, because when I say that we can change the world from the bottom up through our own action, separate from, oh, what political party do you support? Right? That's really what I'm talking about. And frontlineheroesusa.org, that's the place you can learn more about it. frontlineheroesusa.org, all one word. It's an example, I think, about how we can and have come together as just individuals, not to compete with the government and try to get masks and face shields and the like to our frontline heroes, our doctors, our nurses, our EMTs, our first responders. But also, we're not going to wait for them either, right? Right? We're not trying to get out there and buy a million masks and drive up the price of this stuff, but we're not going to wait either. And so what we've done is we've built, I like to call it, an underground railroad of PPE, personal protective equipment, where, you know, we've got 20 people over in China who are buying this equipment where it's cheap and plentiful, shipping it over here, small quantities, but then we bundle it up and we reship it straight into the hands of the doctors and nurses and first responders who need it. So to date, we've raised, gosh, a little over $800,000. We've already distributed 50,000 N95 masks to about 600 individual clinics and hospitals and fire departments all across the country. You know, we're not there to send 10,000 masks to a hospital system, but if you're a nurse in a, you know, a pediatric ward who needs 100 masks for your team, if you're an ER doc, right, who needs 200 masks for the team, we can do that. We can absolutely do that. So frontlineheroesusa.org. It's, you know, we're just getting started, man. We can all do things like this, right? We can all, and this is kind of, I think you're probably going to ask the question because you're saying that, you know, what can we do? This is what we can do. We can do two things, Aaron. We can consume information differently. And by that, I mean, whenever I read a story or I hear somebody on TV telling me about politics or economics or something, I always ask myself, why am I hearing this now? Right? It's not just the what that you're hearing, it's the why. And that's not to be conspiratorial, it's just to ask the question. Because so much of what we hear has got a purpose behind it, right? It's they're telling us, they're shaking their finger at us to try to get us to think a certain way.
The conspiratorial, or the notion of a conspiracy that has one very specific connotation of like the person out in the field with the tinfoil hat, but there's also the you know, conspiracy of a plan that was concocted in a small group to achieve an aim. And like the nuance of understanding the difference in those two words and the fact that a large corporation, I saw some ridiculous statistic about the number of communications professionals that are employed by Amazon relative to like most media outfits, right, as an example of that. And that's, It in those terms, it's not a conspiracy in the traditional sense or in the kind of internet sense. It's a explicit strategy by one of the largest companies around.
That's right. It's absolutely a strategy. And I think if you could just, again, it's one of those things where it's a good process, right? It's not an answer. It won't give you the answer, but it's just a healthy process, I think, to see the world more clearly. So I think we can all do that. We can all look at the world and think more critically, not to criticize, but think critically about the information that we are barraged with. And then the second thing is we can take action, right? Not on some grand stage. I mean, it really is taking action in your own community. Helping out a food bank I'll call it food security, right? There's such a need for that. We all know something we can do to help. We all know we can do more. We are tricked into believing that those small acts of kindness and charity don't mean much in the big scheme of things. that if you're not, you know, putting posters out in your front yard to vote for X or vote for Y, you're not really changing the world. And that's just bullshit. Sorry, use the language. It's just bullshit. It's those small acts of community engagement. That's everything. That's everything. And it really does change the world. It's the long game we're playing here. But that's how we're going to get back on the right track and get those small L liberal virtues and those small C conservative virtues back up and going through our own individual actions and our own individual communities.
I believe it. And that's why we end the interviews on that note of action, so we can translate these ideas into something tangible. Ben, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Really my pleasure, Aaron. Thanks for having me.
We just went deep with Ben Hunt. Hope everyone out there has a fantastic day. Thank you so much for listening to the end of my conversation with Ben. If you are interested in other interviews that we've done with leading thinkers in the world of finance, we have an enormous back catalog of those characters: venture investor Andy Ratcliffe, writer Morgan Housel, Bitcoin evangelist Anthony Pompliano, and many, many more. You can go through the library or check the link in the show notes for this episode to find and discover all those great episodes in our back catalog. And if you hit subscribe, I can guarantee you we'll be dropping more fascinating conversations in the coming weeks. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening. Connect with Aaron on Twitter and Instagram at AaronWatson59.